The Tom Woods Show, episode 1826.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, joined today by Andres Namensky, who's a professor of history at the University of Memphis, and who has written a very interesting new book called Socialism as a Secular Creed, a Modern Global History. Very, very absorbing, very, very interesting analysis. Unfortunately, it's one of these academic books with a very high price, so you may want to get it through interlibrary loan at your library if you want to have a chance to read it. You can do that if you have access to any university library with ease, and even your local library will fetch you a book through interlibrary loan. So check that out. I do have it linked at tomwoods.com/1826. Andre, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me to your show. I'm a fan of your show, a regular visitor.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And we both published with Lexington Books on topics having a religious angle to them. So this is also something interesting we have in common. I started to read your book, and what I found at the very beginning, I thought, well, surely I have to ask about this, because it does give a little bit of background to how you came to the topic. You moved to the United States from the, as you describe it, crumbling Soviet Union.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Tell me the circumstances and what your maybe ideological outlook was at the time.
As strange as it may sound, it was the day when the communist regime collapsed in Russia. It's August 1991. Okay, that's when I moved here to the United States. See, at that time, I was still convinced that some kind of democratic socialism was possible, and that Soviet Union somehow distorted this noble dream, polluted, infected it somehow. And I thought somewhere in the West, I would be able to find some answers to my questions, because I knew that the Soviet utopia failed, miserably failed. It was suffocating to be there. But again, instead of staying in Russia, so I decided to move to the West, because I thought that this destruction, creative destruction, would destroy humanities in the Soviet Union. So I decided to do my PhD here in the United States, and that's how I came here. And in fact, our background to some training to some extent similar, because you are a historian of religion and I'm a historian of religion. Is it correct?
Well, certainly part of my work has been in that area, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. That's how I started. Yeah, I was a historian of religion. In fact, my field was indigenous religions, Siberia and North America. So originally I was interested in Native Americans, Native people. I was big into this non-Western cultures, non-Western civilizations originally. That's where I was.
Well, that of course means that we probably need to talk about, and again, this is something you talk about at the beginning of the book, what we think constitutes a religion. Because if you're going to say that socialism qualifies as a secular creed, what are you really saying about it?
Well, see, the gist of my book, and that's what the major thesis, is that too frequently we approach religion based on our experience of the three Abrahamic religions, okay? But if we go to other countries, we will see that it's a more as a moral code. Let's see, if you take a look at Confucianism in China, Buddhism, other religions. So I invite people to look broadly at what I'm trying to show, that in this case, we can fit these ideologies, major ideologies, especially aggressive ideologies, which try to impose on us certain moral code of behavior. We can qualify them also as political religions. And that's what I'm trying to show in my book, especially at the time in the 19th century, when a lot of enlightened minds, so to speak, they decided to ditch religions and they had to find some kind of substitute. And that's where the substitute was coming. And that's how we come to this powerful, potent socialism, because it naturally came to fill this void, especially for people who are obsessed with the science worship. I'm sure all of your listeners heard about Hayek's book, Counter-Revolution of Science, and he explained how these enlightened minds in France and England, they came to fill this void. Henri Saint-Simon, Robert Owen. And that's how naturally religion of socialism stepped in, because socialism in the 19th century was viewed as a religion, scientific religion, like philosophical stone that could provide answers to all our questions.
I think some of the reason people maybe miss this aspect of the question is that they get hung up on how anti-religion, in the sense in which you're talking about, where people think, well, this is the religion as I've experienced it, given my experience with the three Abrahamic religions. They look at what Marx has to say about it, and they think, okay, this has nothing in common with, this is the opposite of religion. You're talking about even people who were writing before Marx, or were contemporaries, but their writings were a little bit earlier. Some of the other socialists of the 19th century did certainly have some kind of spiritual dimension to what they were writing. So what are we to make of these original texts, you know, as we approach the kind of thesis that you're trying to put forward? How do they fit into this?
See, in order to understand what we're talking about here, so we have to look into what was going on in Enlightenment in these Protestant sects that became frustrated with traditional religion. So we have to talk about fringe sects that were active during the Enlightenment, during the Great Awakening, that started to secularize themselves. And they became very aggressive, promoting atheism, promoting science, trying to impose this on society. Okay, there was obsession. We have to put, as a historian, I invite you to put ourselves in the shoes of people at that time. So there was a lot of obsession with scientific mindset. So people were impressed with these miracles of science. And it was a culture of reading. They liked to read the books. And it was a culture of the Bible critique. So a lot of people started to criticize the Bible. And that's the gap where eventually utopian socialists like Robert Owen, Saint-Simon, and Marx came in. Okay, they started to argue, we're also scientific. We're going to bring you the answers to all your questions. And remember, you just mentioned that there was a powerful spiritual dimension here. And that's what people don't understand sometimes. So we have, on the one hand, we have this obsession with science, and that's how socialism positioned itself. So we are science. Everything is what we are doing scientific. But at the same time, both Robert Owen and followers, especially Marx, they provided these millions of people who were ready to subscribe to their prophecies, this powerful guiding light, the prophecy, that golden age, the paradise. So it was a substitute for traditional religious eschatological view that there would be better than yesterday. So they merge this pop science with this powerful spiritual prophecy that the heaven on earth. And that's what provided this potent force to these forces that try to hijack the mindset of the people. So, and that's what I'm arguing, because sometimes people on the right, they treat socialism, Marxian socialism, as some kind of imposition. But unfortunately, it's also part of Western culture, Western civilization, that came to hijack inorganic way, came to hijack people's minds and spontaneously developed up to a certain point and led to these destructive results, which we saw in the 20th century.
So in other words, it was more than just a dry series of academic propositions, socialism, because very few people get drawn into things like that. If just really just a few nerds are interested in just dry abstract propositions, there was something more here.
Exactly.
That appealed beyond just the brain, basically.
Exactly. It's a very ideological, but ideology, as I said, that rooted itself in the mindset of people that came to feel this void, spiritual void that a lot of people felt at that time. Not only educated intellectuals, but some people among the grassroots and cities with elementary education. And we also have to keep in mind that in the 19th century, people were frustrated about this satanic meals, you know, industrial revolution. They had this notion that the entire world was going to hell. Remember, it's English poets in the Romantic Age, they literally cursed what was going on, these factories. Okay, we remember the movement of Luddites. They tried to wreck equipment, killing factory managers. So that's where Marxism eventually steps in, and it says we shouldn't destroy these facilities that have been created by so-called capitalism. And that's what romantic poets or Luddites wanted. They wanted to destroy this industrial order and go back to this medieval guild. The Marxists and the socialists said, no, we need to take it over and use it. So that's another powerful thing. So they capitalized on people's frustrations with the industrial order. But they said, instead of destroying these factories, we have to nationalize them. We have to bring this big brother that would be on the top, and we will share everything. And that's how we will usher society into this golden future. And that's how the idea of the big state comes in, okay? Because if we look into the mindset of Robert Owen, it's one of the first English socialists, okay? Henri Saint-Simon, one of the first French socialists, Karl Marx, this obsession with this force that would be able to control the forces of industrial order, the forces of nature. So that became the big obsession. So the idea of the big state comes to occupy a prominent place in all doctrines of the first socialists, okay? And ironically, Robert Owen, one of the first socialists, when he traveled to the Caribbean islands, he made a strange statement which might surprise the socialism acolytes. He looked at how slaves lived in Jamaica and the Caribbean islands, and he said, hey, they live much better lifestyle than English workers, because English workers were uprooted by the industrial order, but the slave masters in Jamaica, they control everything. They take care of everything. Look at these slaves. So that's what some people don't want to hear. So it was an invitation to this controlled society where there would be a group of enlightened masters on the top who would micromanage everything.
Just given the limited time we have, I want to fast forward to the Bolshevik Revolution and the years that followed that. Because after the Bolshevik Revolution, you have the chapter on Stalin, where the outlook of the Bolsheviks becomes more nationalistic, the socialism in one country program. We're going to focus on this. But what we see in the, well, certainly in Christianity, are certainly worldwide ambitions, that we want the whole world to follow Christ. And you would think that that would be part of the appeal, such as it is, of socialism, that we're bringing something extraordinary to the world. How do they transition from that spiritually into, we're going to focus just on ourselves? It lacks the universalism of Christianity in that case.
Exactly right. But you mentioned a very important phrase. You made some kind of comparison. You said that a message of Christianity was worldwide brotherhood of people. In fact, socialism coming as a substitute, trying to substitute for traditional religions, also claims that internationalism, especially Marxian socialism, that workers have nothing to lose except their chains, so let's get together and poor against the rich, let's overthrow them. But as soon as socialism, in any case, by the way, and that's another, the second line of my book, in any case, when internationalist socialists, including Marxians or Marxist-Leninists in Russia, as soon as they came and tried to fulfill it, to plant it on the ground, it immediately acquired national socialist forms, pardon my expression. So that is why I feel a bit uncomfortable using this expression, because I do see in national Bolshevism of Stalin elements of national socialism, which we may find in Nazi national socialist Germany, which we find today in present day China, which also fits this paradigm of national socialism. But how it happens? It happens simply because nationalism is more potent ideology than socialism. So it has this indigenous roots, and that's exactly what happened in the Soviet Union. But what we have in the Soviet Union, it was not totally mono-ethnic country like Germany, where Hitler had the chance to milk German nationalism, to link nationalism and socialism and creating this doctrine of national socialism. Soviet Union was still a multi-ethnic society. So Stalin tried to gamble to on interests of Russians. He tried to placate interests of Russians, but he could not go full ahead in this direction where Hitler went. So Soviet Union was a multi-ethnic country. So he had to placate other groups. So he had to dance between Russian nationalism and elements of international socialism. And that's how Soviet Union survived until the very end, 1991. So they literally were dancing between international socialism and nationalism. The same with Yugoslavia, Tito's Yugoslavia. They also had somehow to placate other nationalities. But again, the experience of socialism proves that in competition with nationalism, international socialism always loses. And all these former communist apparatchiks, as we know, they rebranded themselves internationalists, like Milosevic in Serbia, Nazarbayev in Kazakhstan, or Zyuganov in present-day Russia, who is head of the Communist Party. It's a red-brown forces that combine elements of nationalism and socialism.
Let me ask another question about the way we're talking about religion. I mean, we can think of it, because as you say, if we go to, and I've covered this on another episode, if we go to non-Western societies, in some cases, we will discover traditions that we describe as, quote, religious, because that's a category that we have in Western thought, but it doesn't, they don't quite look like Western, quote unquote, religions. So you were mentioning examples of this. So are we thinking of religion as being a set of beliefs that people hold, or is there more to it than that? Does it have to have an eschatology? Does it have to have a chosen people? What does it have to have?
So it has, it should have a little bit of both, because everything should be looked at the individual or a concrete cultural experience. For me, it's a moral force, a spiritual force that provides a spiritual satisfaction to either an individual person or to a group of people. It's not always about salvation, so we have to remember this. For instance, in China, why in China to the present day we still have socialism, or literally Marxism-Leninism, so radical form of socialism, still popular, because it does fit the paradigm of traditional Confucian culture. It's a political dimension, this hierarchy, this belief that morally you can change people, so you can educate them, you can upgrade them. That was the major message of Confucianism, okay? If we go to Europe, for instance, in Southern Europe, we see that communist parties were more popular in France and Italy, where Catholic religions were more popular. So they tried to act as substitute. When we go to Northern Europe, we see social democratic parties are more popular because they are more, I would say, individual oriented. So communism with its control and command structure was not popular in Northern Europe, okay? But essentially, it goes down to what we are looking for in a particular religion or ideology, okay? And what is interesting for me in this book, so how people behave in a moment of crisis, okay? These linchpins, landmarks, when people go through a crisis, so what kind of choices do they make, okay? In this case, Industrial Revolution, 1917, First World War. So the choice, unfortunately, was made in favor of these two powerful blocks of socialism, like communism and social democracy. Okay, that's another thing I want to show in my book. These two big factions of socialism, which were operating under the same red flag, and how these two forces spread around the world and how they grounded, how in the particular indigenous cultures, how they link themselves to Chinese culture, to Cambodian culture, okay, or to American culture, because in the last chapter, I do write a bit about how in the present day United States, socialism tries to link itself to particular notions of American culture, counterculture, spirituality. So it's very interesting to investigate.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, BetterHelp. We're still toward the beginning of the year, and I still do believe in the power of New Year's resolutions. And if you've been struggling with something that has been preventing you from enjoying real happiness, whether it's depression or you're stressed out or you've got anxiety or you're grieving and you can't get over it, This is not a fated existence. Nothing says you have to go through your life like this, and BetterHelp can help you. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can start communicating in under 24 hours. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. And they're committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if you should need to. And by the way, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. Well, I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/woods. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/woods. Can we talk about China for a minute? Because a lot of times when we talk about communism, we talk about Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. And yet China is important not to overlook, if for no reason other than its size.
Absolutely.
And not to mention the scale of the atrocities that were committed. How does your thesis apply in the case of Maoism?
I'm glad that you asked this question, because it's a landmark question, I would say, because what Chairman Mao Zedong did, he actually opened the doors to what today we call a cultural left. Some people call it cultural Marxism. And one of the elements, we talk a lot about Frankfurt School and everything, but we kind of don't notice what Maoist did. Essentially, what he did, he found a replacement for traditional industrial proletariat, which had been worshipped by Karl Marx, because the notion of traditional Marxism was that industrial workers, they were the salt of the earth. These were the noble savages that would come, and they would go under the leadership of Communist Party that would save the world. See this eschatological idea, so coming from Judeo-Christian idea. When Russia under Lenin was ready for the revolution, so Russia was not industrialized country. So Lenin made the first step in this direction, which later Chairman Mao perfected. So Lenin said, yes, it was correct what Marx had said, but look, we have a little bit of workers, but Russia is a peasant country. So why don't we offer a new message to the grassroots? Why don't we say that so-called proletarians, industrial proletarians, they would lead the ball, so they would lead the revolution, but the peasants, traditional peasants, that would be allies, okay? And that's when China comes in, because in 1949, when Chairman Mao, Chinese communists, they were ready to take power, there was hardly any industrial working class in China, okay? So they had to find a substitute. And that's how Mao said, okay, Lenin said peasants could be allies, but we are going further. We are saying that Communist Party would like the force, proletarian force, that would lead whom? Peasants, because China is a peasant country. And that's what later attracted the Third World, because they said, look, in China, under the leadership of Communist Party, peasants were treated as surrogate proletarians. Why don't we do it in Angola, in Ethiopia, in other countries? And that's how the new image of the noble savage was shaped. So these noble Third World peasants who would liberate the world. And remember, 1960s, 1970s, that's how these new left come to the picture, and they begin to worship Third World people, okay? And essentially, we have the new left who tried to look for noble savages within the Western countries, since we don't have peasants. Who are their noble savages within France? Who are the noble savages within England and the United States? And of course, it's the people of color, some sexual, gender minorities. So these were peddled as the new noble savages that would come to act as surrogate proletarians. So that's what interesting to investigate, to look in, because we shouldn't forget this. So one of the shaping forces of the cultural left. And of course, we have today these debates between the cultural left that worship these non-proletarian elements and traditional Marxists, Trotskyites, who said, no, we still have workers, and they attack each other, okay? One of the recent interesting debates was the debate between traditional Marxists and socialists and cultural left about this famous project, 1619, when the cultural left said, oh, it's everything, the human history about this racial capitalism. Okay, the traditional left said, no, it's about Marxian capitalism. So we should divide people by class. We shouldn't divide them by race. And so they fight each other.
It's interesting to observe these fights, because it's not clear how the Marxian revolution would occur with something other than the working class as a driving force and something other than the working class's grievances as the driving force. It was supposed to be the progressive immiseration of the working class because of certain problems inherent in capitalism. And that's not quite the kinds of complaints that they're talking about, police brutality and a whole bunch of other things that were not really front and center in Marxism.
I should let me interrupt you for a second. I think the traditional left, of course, they have a losing case in this case because, look, how another element why culture left, you know, identitarian left came to dominate the left spectrum. Because in 1960s, 1970s, this traditional working class, industrial class, it was almost gone, okay? It evaporated. And that's how another reason why the cultural left came to dominate the scene, because they started looking for new classes of people to fill this void. So who is going to be this noble savage? So I don't think they would win the cause, because today in the United States, at least, I know for sure that working class traditionally vote Republican. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Can I ask you, by the way, just the most basic of questions? Suppose you're right. Suppose you've made the case that the Marxist and various forms of socialist movements that we've seen have the elements of a creed and in some ways resemble a religion. How are we helped in our understanding of this? How can we, as we go into the future, better assess the situation that we face vis-a-vis such people if we understand this insight of yours?
Well, the major, even though I said the traditional Marxists, they have a losing ground. But right now, of course, cultural left, identitarian left, they dominate the scene. But essentially what they do, they try to convince us that the group loyalty, this balkanization of people in particular groups, which is related to traditional Marxists and the current identitarian left, it's a group loyalty is the major thing, okay? And trying to identify this particular groups of victims. In fact, the left, they step on a very shaky ground, even identitarian left. Look, right now, for instance, this popular theory of intersectionality, for instance, they said they question this traditional left paradigm of ethno-racial pentagon, where we have like white, black, yellow, brown, and superficial. Okay, they said we should dissolve these categories because if, for instance, I am a black woman, okay, so I'm more oppressed than the black woman because I'm not only black, I'm a black woman. But if I'm a handicapped, so I'm also more oppressed because I'm not only a black woman, I'm a black handicapped woman. So essentially what I'm trying to say, we have a bunch of categories of oppression which left offer us this alphabet soup of these categories. And essentially, you know, it's a self-defeating theory because it brings us down to an individual. So we come to an absurd situation that each of us were both victims and oppressors, okay? And that's where I think the Austrians and libertarian theory has something to say, because I'm sure you heard about methodological individualism. So essentially, it's about us, the people, as individuals, okay? That's where we have to operate. That's where we have to look at.
One thing also that I want to point out is there's been a lot of talk about the difference between the left today and the left in the old days. And as you've pointed out, there's obviously the emphasis on identity politics, but there hasn't been that much talk or as much work done on exactly how that change occurred, how that transition occurred. I mean, you may think that it was after the collapse of the regimes behind the Iron Curtain, and maybe that did accelerate the move because it became toxic in most people's eyes to be associated with Marxism. But even before that, I was quite struck. I was not aware of, I was struck by this quotation from Foucault in your book that I was not aware of. Foucault, of course, is one of the heroes of the left. And after Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago came out in 1973, which dealt with the concentration camps under Stalin, Foucault said, "Don't talk to me about Marx anymore. I never want to hear anything about that man again. Ask someone whose job it is, someone paid to do it. Ask the Marxist functionaries. Me, I've had enough of Marx." And the way you put it, you say, The intellectual hegemony of Marxism in France, which lasted from 1945 to about 1975, abruptly ended, and that people were looking for an acceptable exit among intellectuals from Marxist socialism. I was just interested in that because I hadn't actually been aware of how that started to happen.
See, it's related to the grand failure of this, so to speak, philosophical stone of traditional Marxism, because traditional Marxian socialism positioned itself as a total theory that would be able to explain everything. Remember, Vladimir Lenin, the famous Marxist-Leninist, he actually said that the teaching of Marxism is true because it's correct. So it was like explanation of the entire world. And this paradigm was crumbling down in the 1970s, okay? And that's when we have postmodernism coming to the picture, okay? So essentially, invitation to look at the world as a bunch of conflict theories, okay? When everybody has a right to his or her own truth, and including each group, okay? But there was a very dangerous situation for the left, because one of the messages of postmodernism was, if everybody has his or her right to a truth, so how can you make a case, left case? And that's when the left made this big case that we have to look at who is oppressed, okay? So we have to make a conscious choice who in favor of groups who are oppressed. And that's how these groups of people in the Third World were chosen, the particular groups inside the Western countries were chosen as the ones that had to be supported. Since everything is relative, but you have to make a choice. You use your choice by using your subjective feelings. You know, we see who is oppressed, it's up to you. And that is why you mentioned Foucault. He desperately begins to shop around. You know, he goes to Iran. It's 1979. He begins to cater to these Iranian ayatollahs because he thought that maybe this radical Islam would be the force that would fill this void. Of course, it was a brief romance. He became disillusioned. So they were like crazies going around looking for these new forces. Who is going to fill this void? Okay, it didn't happen overnight, of course. We have a bunch of interesting characters doing this job of deconstruction of traditional Marxism and shaping this cultural Marxism or cultural left. Like, there was a sociologist in the United States, Wright Mills, who attacked traditional Marxism. He called it the Victorian Marxism. So let's ditch it. And so we need to find new classes. This guy, Mills, Wright Mills, he actually said that, oh, no, it wouldn't be peasants. It wouldn't be some gender sexual minorities. It would be intellectuals, because intellectuals, this is the class of people who would save the world. So he tried to pick up theory of Antonio Gramsci, this Italian Marxist who argued along the same lines and using this. So there were a lot of forces in 1960s, 1970s, 1980s, which had to deal with this grand crisis, collapse of traditional Marxism. And eventually, through the cultural wars, through these debates, they shape this vague theory that dominates right now the left, people on the left. That's how it goes.
This may be an unfair question, but why do you think the world wound up having to learn the hard way about Marxism? That there were at least professed Marxist regimes. I know there were Marxists who claimed that they weren't really Marxist, but they claimed to be Marxists. They didn't claim to be followers of Robert Owen. They claimed to be Marxists. Why do you think it is that of all the socialist theorists of the 19th century, Marx came out on top in terms of influence?
It's actually, explanation is a very simple, because unlike his predecessors, like Robert Owen, Saint-Simon, Marx despised them. He called them utopians. The folks who preceded Karl Marx, Engels, and Moses Hess, they tried to build these grand theories how people would live their life, how would they exist after socialism wins. So they build up grand utopias. Marx said, we're not going to do it. We're going to destroy the old society. So we are not going to speculate how we're going to exist. So we're going to destroy existing society. We will have this force called Communist Party, and it will show us the way. So the details would be clear later. And another thing, as I said, unlike Robert Owen and like Saint-Simon are the utopians. Karl Marx provided this scientific, quote-unquote, explanation. So he made socialism scientific. Actually, Friedrich Engels, one of his friends who actually provided financially for Karl Marx, he argued that our socialism, Marx and Engels, it's scientific socialism because we are building the theory of social evolution. So that's how they plugged in. They used the Charles Darwin theory of evolution for the analysis of society, okay? Because it looked very attractive, the superficial theory built by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, because they build up the theory of social evolution. Remember, 19th century, it was a theory of evolution. Everybody was obsessed with this, this educated minds. What they did, they said, society goes through particular stages, from primitive stage to high stage, primitive communism, then slavery, feudalism, capitalism. And then at the end of capitalism, when society created huge material forces, society would be ripe with this revolt. And that's when the final judgment comes. The workers revolt and they destroy capitalism and they enter this golden paradise. So it did look very attractive and quote-unquote scientific. So that's the reason. It's a scientific prophecy. That's how I define Marx and socialism. Scientific prophecy. And that's what conquered the minds of the people, some of the people.
Well, of course, we could do a separate episode on just how scientific the claims really were. But it's incredible to me the purchase that the word science has on people's minds. All they need to do is hear it, and all critical analysis just drops away. If something is scientific, so-called.
We have a lot of people today who say, look, you have to do, you're obligated to do this because science tells you so. And if you object, you have to be either locked or relegated somewhere to a particular group of despised people. So, and unfortunately, the last century, 20th century, we saw how the science, especially Marxian science or National Socialist science, was used as an excuse for horrendous crimes.
Well, the book we've been talking about is Socialism as a Secular Creed, A Modern Global History. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1826. We should probably, I think we should probably revisit this and cover some more material at some point in the future, because this is a substantial work and very important, and I have a roughly 30-minute podcast that can barely do it justice. So maybe if you would indulge me, we might have another conversation at some point in the future.
Absolutely. I will be more than happy to come again, and thank you for having me today.
Thank you very much. Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, I want to tell you about a website created by a member of the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party, and it's KojinCastle.com, KojinCastle.com. It was created during the lockdown hysteria of 2020. They've got humorous, often snarky, personalized, print-on-demand mugs, T-shirts, necklaces, much more, printed and shipped from the U.S., a great site for gifts, including Valentine's Day gifts. So for the next time you need a great gift or supplies for a big event, KojinCastle.com is the website. They're also on Etsy as Kojin Castle. And they want to thank the great and heroic Adam Schneider. I'll have him on one of these days, who is the libertarian expert on print-on-demand. And apparently he helped them get started. He's helped the Mises Caucus in general and now this site. So if you need a gift, check out KojinCastle.com, KojinCastle.com. I'll link to them at tomwoods.com/1825. And remember, if you're thinking of starting a website, all you got to do is get your hosting through my link and I'll promote you here on the Tom Woods Show, because boy, the worst thing that can happen to you is you start a website and then just tumbleweeds go by, right? You don't want that. Old Woods here will send you some traffic, plus some free tutorials and membership in my private bloggers group. And none of these things cost you a cent. They're just free bonuses I give you. How do you get these bonuses? Check out the details at tomwoods.com/publicity before you start your site, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.